We have now a continuation of our discussion that we began before lunch. We also are going to have the pleasure of Geshe Damdul Namgyal, who will be joining us. He has been most recently, since 2010, he's been serving as a senior resident teacher at the Drepung Losling Monastery in Atlanta. So his English is perfectly fluent, and we're delighted also with his scholarship and wisdom that he'll be joining and bringing to these questions. So he'll also be making a presentation for Your Holiness and the rest of us. We are going to be continuing, as I said, and some of the themes that we took up and ended with concerning emotion regulation, concerning the whole body as part of this system of the mind as well. And both of our presenters will begin first with Richard Davidson and then with Tanya Singer.
Is on? Yes, thank you. Thank you for your time again. Over the course of lunch, we scurried and looked at the scientific literature and wanted to respond to your question about intelligence to start with. This slide, which I'll go through in detail, comes from an article that appeared in a very well-known neuroscientific journal a number of years ago that summarized the current neuroscientific understanding of the brain correlates of what is typically thought of as intelligence by the psychological and neuroscientific community, the kind of mainstream view. And the mainstream view of what intelligence is what is measured by an IQ test. That is the conventional view of what intelligence is. Yeah. So an IQ test has a number of different subcomponents, and the single number that you obtain on an IQ test represents a summary of a number of subtests, typically about 12 subtests, 6 what we call verbal and 6 nonverbal. So, for example, one of the subtests is counting backwards. So if I gave you a number like 758 and asked you to count backwards by 4 and just keep counting, that's one of the kind of tasks on this test.
Solens was saying that according to that test, he will turn out to be zero.
Well, I was going to quickly add that my sense of what you mean by intelligence, Your Holiness, is so much richer than what is measured by an IQ test. And I think that some of our discomfort this morning about in thinking how to respond to your question was because I think most of us around this table would agree that what is measured by an IQ test is just a small fraction of human intelligence and that we need to have a much more inclusive definition. And so I think that some of the discussion that you had with Jhimpala about what may constitute intelligence in terms of how to skillfully respond in different situations, that's a much broader concept, which I think probably is broader than, it's definitely broader than what's measured by an IQ test, and likely involves the participation of many different parts of the brain that come together to accomplish whatever the task is at hand. But I can go through this diagram, and this is the what we know. A kind of summary of based on intelligence as defined by the IQ test. So the image on the left represents the The areas that are colored in red are the areas of the brain that are the most genetically influenced. They're the most heritable. So,
genetically inherited.
And the orientation is that with that image, that's the side view of the head, and the front, which is the most left-hand part of the figure, is the frontal cortex. And one of the things that you can see is that there's a lot of red in that area, and that means that the gray matter, the cell bodies of the brain, show in that area particularly a strong genetic influence. The brain image in the middle is a brain image that contrasts the brain activity during the performance of tasks on the intelligence test compared with tasks that are not very intellectually demanding, very easy tasks. And what you can see is that one of the key areas that is activated, that's shown in red, is in that prefrontal cortex, which we keep talking about. And then finally, the last image on the right is an image that depicts the relationship between it's across individuals, and it's showing that those individuals that are more intelligent as measured by an IQ test show more activation in this prefrontal region of the brain. So the picture that we get from this indicates that at least as what's measured by an IQ test or an intelligence test, the prefrontal cortex is very, very important, and also that is an area of the brain that's strongly genetically influenced.
Да? Чангдок. Я дина шиёнту юна бана.
So here you are referring to kind of more genetically kind of based expression of intelligence which seem to be more inborn or what about trained intelligence?
It's a very important question. This does not reflect necessarily trained intelligence. The performance on an IQ test, as we currently have an IQ test in the West, is influenced by genetics. So it shows a fairly substantial influence of genetics. That doesn't mean that it can't be influenced by training. It simply means that genetic influences are one source of influence, but training could be another source. We know that if you engage in certain kinds of training to strengthen the activity in the prefrontal cortex, you can actually change it. So, for example, you can train a person on what is called a working memory task, and a working memory task is a task such as the working memory is what is required if someone tells you a telephone number and asks you to remember that telephone number, 7 digits or 10 digits, and then you have a cup of tea, and then 5 minutes later you have to recall that, or 3 minutes later even, that telephone number. Keeping it in your mind is something that requires working memory. That's something that at least to some extent can be trained, and when you train it, it influences exactly that area of the brain, the prefrontal cortex.
Intelligence.
Yeah, but that's more to do with memory rather than intelligence.
Yes. That's an important point. It turns out that the prefrontal cortex influences not just memory, but also aspects of intelligence.
Isn't the idea that if you have a good working memory, you are able to recall the necessary information to act intelligently? Dirisha. Negab good temper, the Abuyuna. Tina, Nizu Manga Nya to Yobenza, Nizu Manga Nya Tuna, and Tichuki, Kapta Dumbe.
Christoph wants to make a point.
No.
Number two. Can someone switch on the number two?
Beep, beep.
Yeah, that's what works. Yeah.
So it turns out that working memory is one of the best predictor of intelligence. Not long-term memory, but the ability to quickly store information and a minute later recall it turns out to be very closely correlated to IQ, which is different from long-term memory. But if I ask you, how do you get from here back home, and what is on the right side of the road when you leave, that sort of ability, this very flexible, fluid form of intelligence, that relates well to IQ, which does predict quite well outcome in life, by the way. So,
In
life. So in the defense of the conventional IQ test, high IQ tends to predict how well you do in school, how well you do in university, whether you end up in prison. It tends to predict your income. So it certainly correlates with all those things that are outcomes of real life behaviors. It doesn't predict wisdom, probably.
Yeah, although...
yang zhuri shi me de ba ya ta ga zui nim ji yo cha de ji zhuri pe na ku ri ta sim ji pe lo chong ma de me da ba la do ga
so from the experience of Tibetan monastic education we generally distinguish among individuals variability. Some individual students tend to have a very good memory capacity, so they're able to memorize extensively. Some individuals display much greater aptitude towards debate and critical, kind of discussion. And some individuals... And for example, there are some great scholars, who are very good debaters, but when it comes to memorization, they can barely manage a single stanza, four lines. And then you have the opposite example where there are students and scholars who can memorize literally hundreds and hundreds of folios, but when it comes to debating, they're pretty hopeless. And then Solomon was saying that a third, there are individuals who seem to have a real aptitude for being able to have a greater comprehension, to be able to get to the point, to be able to understand things in a much more comprehensive manner.
So this also is a bit...
So there seem to be many different facets to what we call intelligence.
This is exactly
the...
And there seem to be also probably a factor of habituation as well.
This was exactly the point I was making this morning, that there are many different forms of intelligence, and the kind of variations that you describe likely are associated with different circuits in the brain, not all the same.
If I may add something, it is a very interesting what you just said. We have words for it, and we call one aspect of intelligence crystallized intelligent, and this is knowledge-based. It's people who can memorize a lot and can bring that as argument. And then we have fluid intelligence, like a river, and this is more the ability to use items and recombine them.
Flexible.
It's like cognitive flexibility and how much items you can use and recombine and put in a row. And that's what we call fluid intelligence. And one is mapping with the prefrontal cortex.
Which is fluid intelligence.
Which is fluid. And the memory is rather stored somewhere else, which is more the temporal lobes or hippocampus. is necessary for memory.
다디딘저도 싫어 차와 싸와 누워 싸와 싸트로
안 This seems to be correlated to another aspect of the Buddhist kind of education theory, if you want. We speak of clear intelligence, people who have an ability to think clearly. And then, sort of heightened intelligence, you know, people who have really very, very vast and great.
무슨 남산 시에 통해 14억 사람 해봐.
So these intelligence, for example, the people who have this quite a vast capacity, they have the ability to understand things, you know, rather quickly, but they may not be necessarily good at the details. And then you have people who have this
14.
Very clear intelligence.
That is 14억 사람.
And these are individuals who have a gift for being able to really get to the bottom. To really see things and tease them out in a very clear line of thinking.
And then
swift intelligence. You know, people who don't need to, you know, expend too much energy trying to get it, get something. You know, they have this ability to be swift, to get it swiftly. So then another one is called, you know, penetrating intelligence or profound intelligence. These are individuals who have this aspect which really relates more to be able to kind of draw out the implications so that one is not stuck in a particular kind of, you know, surface level of meaning, but they're able to really, you know, get behind and really think through the implications.
Mm-hmm.
So, having said that, His Holiness was saying that if we don't find support, you know, from the brain scientist in some form of brain kind of correlate or expression, then maybe we can begin to say, well, these are all nice constructs.
So that's why very, very useful discussing. Yes.
Okay. Well, Your Holiness, I'd like to move on now shift to another topic back to emotion and consider the idea of emotion regulation, our capacity to regulate our emotions, and one specific aspect of it, which is a quality, for lack of a better term, I've called stickiness. And I'll say much more about what I mean by that. And a more technical term we can call recovery. So imagine a person who might have a dispute with a friend or a spouse in the morning, and it colors their whole day. They are in a negative mood after that, and they may interact in a tense or an aggressive way with other people after that initial negative interaction. We can think of their emotions in that case as being sticky. That is, their negative emotions persist beyond the point where the original interaction occurred. They have a difficulty, we can say, in regulating their emotions, or difficulty in recovering once an afflictive conflict occurred. So we can illustrate this with two people. One of them is shown here, and another is shown there. So imagine that at the time labeled 3, some stressful event occurs, some kind of argument, and the person that's labeled A shows a much longer persistence of their response, whereas the person labeled B comes back more quickly. They're not as sticky. They are just responding in the moment and then returning.
So the other individual is still clinging on to something.
Yeah? Yes. And it's our view that a lot of human suffering is caused by stickiness.
True.
And so if we can better understand the brain systems that are associated with this, and then look to see what kinds of contemplative interventions might affect this, we may be able to help decrease this kind of suffering. So, this is the brain picture. On the top is the amygdala. Mm-hmm. We've talked about this before, and the areas that are shaded in red and yellow represent the amygdala. This is a slice in the brain that we call a coronal slice that goes, it just, if I were to slice just in front of my ears and open it up, that's what we would see. Now, it turns out that we can measure the recovery of the activation that we can record in the amygdala. Some people show the activation persisting for a longer period of time. Other people recover more quickly. And so the question is, for the people that show a long response, how do they differ from the people that show a shorter response? That's the first question. And it turns out that the people who show a longer response are people who are more anxious. They report that they worry more, they have more tension in their body, they're more disturbed. And we can look at that if you look at the diagram at the bottom left. The individuals who are in the red are the more anxious people. The individuals in the blue are the less anxious people, and they recover more quickly. So we can ask what the impact of different contemplative practices are on this kind of response. And what we see is that this is an experiment where we had practitioners, and this was a group that included practitioners in both the Theravadan tradition as well as in the Vajrayana tradition. They had a day where they practiced for 8 hours a simple mindfulness practice, mindfulness of breathing, and a day where they did either compassion or loving kindness. And so they practiced in our laboratory for 8 hours, and then we measured them after they engaged in this day of practice. And what we found is that particularly after the day of compassion practice, the participants show a decrease in this signal in the amygdala. They're showing decreased reactivity as well as faster recovery. And we further looked at the, if you look at the graph on the right, the number of lifetime hours that they engaged in meditation practice was associated with their recovery. The more hours that they practiced, the more rapid the response was. And those are the individuals that are depicted in red. Now, one of the things that we try to do as scientists is to be rigorously honest and really kind of expose all of the problems and the what we say the dirty laundry of our work. And I'd like to share with you...
Dirty laundry is correct.
Dirty laundry is...
Right.
So the blue dots represent individuals who've never done any meditation practice before. And you can see the line in the middle is the mean, and each of those dots represents where the individual lies in terms of his or her ability to recover in this way. And what we see is that in normal people who have had no contemplative training, there's a big range. People are different. Some people naturally recover quickly. Other people take a long time to recover, and they suffer more. And what we found among the meditation practitioners is that only those with the longest length of practice are showing recovery equivalent to the best of the control subjects who've never meditated before. So in other words, One interpretation of this, there are many interpretations. One interpretation is that at least these are all Western practitioners. And it may be that quite a few Western practitioners are attracted to do meditation because they're very anxious to begin with. And it takes them a number of years of practice before they become settled to the extent that even a person who's never meditated before, who's just naturally very emotionally balanced, is. And but so
controls are also Westerners, though.
Yes, they're all Westerners. Yes.
That could be true because, you know, someone needs to be motivated to do meditation. So maybe they have a little bit of problem of unsettledness of mind, so that they're looking for something.
I think that's true.
Many, of course, roughly speaking, generally speaking, many Buddhist centers, Tibetan Buddhist center, there are many members.
You know, many members seem to be a little bit anxious and, you know, have that kind of disturbance.
Well, this is showing up in our data. So
I think that is because of the, in perhaps I think 60s, 70s, perhaps 80s. Then gradually, healthy mind person, more sort of intelligent, and thinking deeper way, then develop some attraction. That is something, I think, different. In 60s, many hippies, I think they disturb their mind already. See, they always look around, you see some answer for their disturbed mind, isn't it? So then they met all sorts of different sort of gurus.
I think that may be an issue, yes. So I wanted to show you one other finding. This is the next one is not from our group. This was done at a group at Harvard where this is, again, looking at the same structure, the amygdala. And what this is, practitioners who go through just 8 weeks of mindfulness-based stress reduction. Your Holiness has heard about this before from our colleague and Mind and Life board member, John Kabat-Zinn, who developed mindfulness-based stress reduction. And what they did in this study is they measured the size, the physical size of the amygdala before and after just 8 weeks of mindfulness meditation practice. And what they found is that among those practitioners who report the most beneficial effects, who show the largest reduction in stress, among those practitioners, the size of the amygdala actually gets smaller over the course of just 8 weeks.
I got the impression the mandala is sort of the basis
of emotion,
of different emotions, both constructive and destructive. So this explanation seems to see the because of the mental state becoming more calm, more sort of
settled,
then mandala itself becomes smaller. So that means the practice compassion, mandala still remain, so the remains or reduce smaller or increase?
The wonderful questions. This is the first and only study that has reported this. So as Your Holiness said yesterday, before we really believe anything in science, we need more studies. But this is an interesting report, and the amygdala clearly is involved more in what we would think of as negative emotion than it is in wholesome positive emotion. It's involved to some extent in both, but clearly more in negative. All of the research suggests that. So we'll see whether this holds up in the scientific literature, but it's a striking finding because it is observed after just 8 weeks of training. Now, we know that the structure of the brain can actually change very quickly. There was actually a very recent study published, which I actually mentioned in our dialogue in Delhi, a study by a very well-known group in Israel, a group of neuroscientists, where they found that after 2 hours of playing a video game that involved racing car drivers, where they had a lot of hand-eye coordination, 2 hours, they found a structural change in the brain after just 2 hours. So the brain is much more dynamic in terms of its structure than we previously thought. That I think is a fair conclusion from all of this work. Constantly changing.
So what about, you know, since we are talking about the amygdala and its role in experience of emotion, what
for
about
example,
sort of...
For example, the self-centered arrogance, I. Some connection with amygdala?
Amygdala.
We don't know the answer to that question. Very likely the amygdala participates.
Combined with sense of concern of other and full of courage, do something. That kind of, sometimes even emotion. This is so much sort of feeling. Tears also come. So that also, in the category of emotion. So some connection with amygdala?
We don't know. We don't know the answer to that.
His Holiness, we will tell you in a year, because in the longitudinal study, we record every day people talking, and then we count how much they say I, me, and how much they spontaneously say we, others. And then we want to see whether this correlates to amygdala activity in the baseline, to exactly answer this question. The hypothesis is people who say more me, me, I should have higher amygdala reactivity.
Children with anxiety disorders and children with autism, young children, have larger amygdala. There are now several studies showing that children who have those disorders, their amygdala is actually physically larger. So I want to now move on to another topic, which is about the body. So far today, all of us have been talking about the brain. And one of the things that we're learning is that the nervous system, we know, extends throughout the entire body. It's not just in the brain. One of my favorite stories when I talk to lay audiences about the research on contemplative practice that I love to share actually happened during the time I met you first, Your Holiness, in 1992. You asked Francisco and I and the other scientists that were with us, if we would please give a talk at the Namgyal Monastery to the young monks about the science that we were doing. And we gave the talk, but we had equipment with us to record brain activity. And so we decided that we would show them how brain activity is recorded rather than just giving a dry academic talk. And our guinea pig on that day was Francisco. And we put electrodes on Francisco's head, and we had to place the electrodes very carefully to make sure the recordings were good. And we were standing in front of Francisco, and we had many laptop computers. And in those days, the laptops were much bigger, so lots of equipment. And then finally, we cleared out of the way so the 200 monks who are sitting on the floor can see what we were doing. And as we cleared out of the way, everyone started laughing, just burst out laughing. And we had no idea why they were laughing. We thought they were laughing because Francisco looked very funny with the electrodes on his head. It turns out that's not what they were laughing about. They were laughing that we were interested in studying compassion by putting electrodes on the head rather than on the heart. And that was a very important lesson for us. And it took many years to really understand in more detail, I think, what it is they were trying to tell us. But we finally got back to the heart. And I'd like to just very briefly share with you this. This is actually an MRI image of the heart. It's something we can do in the MRI scanner. In addition to studying the brain, we can also look at other organs and look at the activity in those other organs. And when we do that, these are experts, expert practitioners. These are experts in the Tibetan tradition. These are very long-term practitioners whose average length of practice is many, many years, about 34,000 hours of lifetime practice. All of them have done three-year retreats. During compassion practice, they actually show an elevation in heart rate compared to novices. It's a small increase, but it nevertheless is very consistent. But what's even more interesting is that there are certain areas of the brain that show a strong relationship between the heart and these areas of the brain that are specific to when the practitioner is engaging in compassion practice. So we would say there's coupling or increased communication between the heart and the brain during those periods. And that's what we see in red here. It's specific to the compassion practice, which is illustrated on the right-hand side. And the novices who are in blue don't show this at all. So this is something very unique to the expert practitioners and suggests that compassion is not just something that's expressed in the brain, but it's expressed in increased communication between the brain and the heart. It's something we think is very interesting and may have something to do with some of the beneficial effects that compassion practice may have on the body.
And blood pressure, 파리고래가 잘 거래.
So what about blood pressure? Does it go up or down?
Blood pressure does not significantly change. We've looked at that. Now, it may be that if a person was angry, we'd see more of a decrease in blood pressure.
그래서
농라이나 decrease. Say that again.
If a person was made to be angry or upset in some way, we may see more of a decrease in blood pressure with compassion. But just in the baseline state,
blood pressure
말해. 지단 체도 있는 농라하루 And they should nyingi kom chuba na.
Alle ho.
Ani blood pressure ma nyingi king kom be king ma. Chae.
Ho de de. Ich so nur leider blood pressure chego so so kol pressure.
His illness his illness nearly misheard thinking that you were saying that if you make someone angry the blood pressure goes down.
Blood pressure. Those people who have high blood pressure, you see, should create more angry, more anger. Okay.
So I'm going to just skip one or two slides in the interest of time, but show you one other kind of experiment that we do where we are looking here at molecules that are important in inflammation. Inflammation is so important for many different diseases. It's important for heart disease, for asthma, for certain kinds of cancers. So if we can understand better how meditation practices may influence inflammation, that potentially could be very helpful. And we have been studying in the laboratory the impact of certain kinds of meditation on inflammation. And what we show here is a person's arm, and we make these very tiny blisters by having a vacuum slowly raise the skin over the course of about 45 minutes. It's really painless. I've had it done to myself, and it's very it's a very benign procedure. What we then do. What we then do is we place some cream. You can see the white cream around it. That cream, is the active ingredient of the cream comes from chili peppers. And it causes the skin to become slightly inflamed. Slightly inflamed. And it's you can see in the next slide, it produces what we call a flare. You can see it better on these TV monitors. We can actually measure the size of that flare and actually look at how quickly it heals. And it turns out that just 8 weeks of mindfulness-based stress reduction results in faster healing of the inflammation, and people who practice more show a greater reduction of molecules that cause inflammation. So this suggests again that the changes that we observe are not just in the brain, but they're also expressed in the body in ways which may be helpful to our health. Now, I want to end with just a little bit about the future and what may be possible in the future with new methods that we have available. And I'll tell you about one kind of experiment which leads us to believe that these methods may be helpful. This is an experiment not on meditation, but an experiment where we took identical twins. So these are what we call monozygotic twins. So they're genetically identical. They have the identical DNA. But if you look at each twin, they vary in how similar or different they are in their well-being and anxiety. One of them shows more well-being and less anxiety than the other. But they vary in how similar or different they are. And it turns out that if you look at enough pairs of identical twins, you'll find some that are very, very similar, but you also find some, even though they're genetically identical, they show differences because they have different life experiences. And if you look at their brain, this is a very complicated slide, but this is showing, it's using a imaging technique that we call diffusion tensor imaging, and it looks at the connections among different brain regions. The important point here is that the more similar the two twins are in their well-being, the more similar the connections are. The more different they are, the more different the connections are, even though they're genetically identical. So this shows that pure experience can clearly affect the brain even in two individuals who are genetically identical. And it suggests that some of these differences may arise through epigenetic mechanisms. And epigenetic mechanisms involve...
Epigenetics la pyugal dana kunzidrasha jin liya chidan nipa yunne ku nipa diya on che maje kichi jorba. Tathirisha epigenetics it. You want to explain what epigenetics is?
Yes, so epigenetics is the regulation of our genes. So our genes can be like a volume control. They can be turned on, they can be louder or softer, turned on or off, and these are mechanisms which govern the extent to which genes are expressed. So there's new methods available. The title of this paper is The Human Brain in a Dish. And what these methods allow us to do, it sounds like science fiction, but these are very prominent scientists. This is published in a very important journal.
No. So can you explain that new technique?
Yes. So you can take a few cells from the skin just by scraping the skin.
Yes.
And take those skin cells, and you can, in a dish, convert them into a stem cell, a pluripotent stem cell. When they're in the stem cell stage, they can be converted to any other kind of cell in the body. And you can actually convert them into different kinds of neurons. Mm. And when you convert them into neurons, you can look at the gene expression in those neurons. And it turns out that the patterns that you see are different from what is seen when they're skin cells. And there is research which indicates that you can look at a group of people like a group of schizophrenics who have a psychiatric disorder, and you can do this technique and you can see that within their skin cells there's no difference. But then when they convert the skin cells to brain cells, all of a sudden you can see differences which help us understand the nature of the illness in this case. But this is a technique that we can apply to humans in other contexts. And so it is a way for us to look actually at brain cells without having to go into the brain itself, because of course we couldn't do that, but just by scraping a few cells of skin. So I expect that in the next few years, these methods will be used to look in a very detailed way at how contemplative practice actually affects the function and gene expressions in specific types of neurons that we can grow in a dish in this way.
So at this level and stage of the biological process, it is purely from the kind of biochemical properties. Nothing to do with consciousness, nothing to do with mental processes.
Well, we don't know the answer to that.
Oh, that's wrong person to ask that. but anyway, you see, the other field, you see, from the Buddhist, from not only Buddhist,
classical,
you see, those people, you see, who accept such thing as a mind or emotion. some effect there. Now here, it's a purely the chemical reaction.
Yeah. Biochemical reactions.
Well, Your Holiness, we have some preliminary data that...
So can you imagine the possibility down the line that through this process we could actually create a full human brain?
I doubt it.
Yes. Right answer. I love that answer.
Well, I think we have
an alternative view.
They do.
There is some experimental data. So the Nobel Prize was awarded
Slow it down. Just speak a little slower.
The Nobel Prize was awarded last year to Yamamochi, the Japanese scientist who discovered this technique. And what the Japanese have shown now, you can take one stem cell from the skin and you put it into a dish and you turn it into an eye. An eye cup with all the cells in the eye there from a single cell. But the eye is not functioning because it's an eye in isolation, it misses lots of factors, but it looks like a complete eye with retinal ganglion cells and photoreceptors. So this is not a brain. It's far away from being a brain, but the potential is all there.
I think that's possible.
So, Your Holiness, thank you so much for your attention, and I look forward over the years to continuing the dialogue.
And we'll see if we are able to find a brain in a dish.
Kasa.
Thank you, Your Holiness and Richie. And we ended with a kind of a mind-body question. You know, is it possible to have a few neurons? Do those neurons have consciousness? And it raises the question of mind and the brain, which is the vehicle of consciousness in the body. And we can ask a similar question really about emotions. You know, the emotions that we have, how are they generated? What's the relationship of the emotions to the body?
Hello again. In this afternoon session, I wanted a little bit to complete the picture I have given in the morning session. In the morning session, we talked about the relationship between behavior, cognitive processes, and neural processes. This model is very general, the model I think every cognitive neuroscientist has. You want to understand phenomena always as an interaction between the level of environment, and that can span from the air we breathe, pollution, to the historical moment, whether we're born in a war or in peace, to the mother we had and how often we have seen. So environment is a broad concept. And then behavior, we talk about subjective experience on one hand, first-person experience, and I think everyone who is sitting here are the masters in that. And we are just beginning a little bit to understand it in Western society. So you are pointing out the scale we use usually is positive, negative, is not very sophisticated. So we're working towards that, but there is the level of subjective experience and the level of behavior. And then we talked about cognitive processes, and these cognitive processes are actually constructs. They are something like memory, attention, orienting attention. When we talk about compassion, for example, behavior would, for example, be a compassionate behavior, and the process would be the feeling of warmth. And then we have the neural level. We're saying every cognitive process has a pendant in cognition, in the brain. Brain-body interaction. So perhaps this is where Buddhism differs from Western science, that we assume But every cognitive process or mind process has a correspondence somewhere in the brain. And then we go one level further and we say there is not only neurons, there are the genes who produce neurons. So that's a level down. And we just heard by Ritchie that genes can influence how our brains are wired. But we also have neurotransmitter. This is the chemistry in our brain which is needed to signal. Without the neurotransmitter, our brain could not talk. So they're very important. And there is a huge science on neurotransmitter because there are different neurotransmitter and different systems have different neurotransmitter. So, for example, depression comes with probably a certain lack of neurotransmitter in the brain, and you can show that and measure that. It's called serotonin. Now, I want to focus now just today on one example, how you can use the knowledge about a certain neuropeptide in the brain, which is also a hormone in the body, and then relate that to the brain, and then relate that to behavior. And the example I will give is the caring system, one very important affiliative system, the affiliation system, and oxytocin. It's just one example of many, many, but it's to make the point of how that comes together. So that was what I showed you in the morning. These are the changes in brain signal after 1 week of loving-kindness training. And we discussed already that this is the baby steps of compassion training. It's the beginning for beginners. And what these subjects do is actually to imagine, the picture mentally of a baby or of a loved one, a dear one, the grandmother or so. So obviously we also thought that that should activate an affiliative or caring system. Because this is what they imagine, this is what they try to develop to increase. Before I want to show you the experiment, I want you to introduce a little bit more complex picture of the system in our brain. So we can distinguish roughly, that's a very simplification, but a useful one, between different systems in our brain and psychology. They exist on the level of psychological function and on the level of biology. On both levels they exist. And perhaps to explain the word motivational system, motivation is needed to drive behavior. This is our concept. So if you don't have motivation, if you don't have motivation, nothing happens. You don't act. You are depressed or you are no motivation. If you have a lot of motivation, you have a goal in pursuit. Now, motivational systems have a certain function. So, for example, one system is called the seeking or wanting system.
So can you explain what you mean by system in brain terms?
System in the sense...
It's functionally defined, yeah?
It's functionally defined, yes. And system because both on the level of brain, but also in level of psychology, it comes with a lot of attributes. It's not just one area or one construct. It comes with a network of attributes on the psychological level and also as a network in the brain. And I may perhaps make a step towards perhaps what Buddhists would say is the seeking system might be the grasping system. We also call it wanting system. It comes with a goal and what a drive I want. So for example, when you win a debate, I saw the monastic debating, and I had the feeling that what was activated is their seeking system, because they were making hiya, and if they win a debate, they were very much happy, and the seeking system comes with high arousal, positive affect, but high arousal. And what is important, I know that His Holiness will have a Mind and Life meeting in Dharamsala in October on addiction. And when you go on to the biologic level, the danger of the seeking system is good. Without this, we would not be curious and asking questions and making signs and what wanting and how is that and so on. But if you are always in that, you can get addicted. You can get addicted to, you know, wanting more, wanting...
So probably it also is partly a function of the kind of object of your desire, what you are seeking.
For sure, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you seek knowledge, no problem. Mm-hmm. But if you seek more money, mm-hmm. getting richer, or more fame, so psychologists make a better distinction and say there is power motivation, achievement motivation, mm-hmm. so very different motivation, play motivation.
These all, oh, yes, okay.
And they are all under the seeking system, and you have to make this difference, but I cannot do all the differences at once. But there is a danger, and we know that the activation of the strong wanting system is correlated with a neurotransmitter system in the brain, which we know is out of balance in addiction, you know, workaholism or drinking. And another very important system, which E. Davidson has talked a lot about already, is threat system. And the function of threat system is protection. And the emotion which can come out, the importance to understand is motivational system is not the same than emotion. But different emotions are likely to come out of a certain motivation system. So here, the threat system is associated either to fear, and fear is like protecting, or to aggression. Because in both cases, your system is in danger. Either you react with anger or with fear. And this is associated on a biological level with the amygdala, which E. David showed. It's high arousal alarm system. And when the amygdala is too activated, the stress system in our body get activated through amygdala. And we can measure that as a hormone in the blood, which is called cortisol. So you have higher cortisol level, you are more stressed. And on the long run, you get ill. So one system which is very important to balance the system is a third one, which we call caring or affiliative system. It comes with often questions, calm. It comes with feeling not of high arousal and winning, but warmth and calm. And is to do with psychological concepts like love, safety, connectedness, just being. And we can also activate it through this. So this is a massage.
Yes.
And if you see that the squirrel, which is massaged, is very much activated quiescent system. And you can show that massage, for example, but also touch, pleasant touch, caring touch, releases a hormone which is called oxytocin. It's a certain hormone which is...
And then licking as well.
Yes, licking too, caring and so on. It is also combined with different neuropeptides, opiates and so on, but I don't want to make the story too complicated. Let's focus on oxytocin.
So,
So, for example, those who own pets like dogs and cats,
yes.
if they lick the owner,
small one,
you know, the
particularly
small,
the young one,
mm-hmm.
like
oh.
their tongues also sometimes very good taste, like that.
So
regularly.
So if they do it regularly, would you see those oxytocins rising in the recipient, the owners?
Yes. So what there is science, not about dogs, but about monkeys. And the monkeys, they groom. You know, they lick
no,
and groom.
But it's asking if the pet were to lick the human
Yes,
owner.
Or whether the pet feels better.
Yes. Mm. No, the, whether
the
human...
human. Probably, yes. I don't know about research. I know that monkeys do that to calm down. You know,
that's
when monkeys,
right,
they...
Right. No, I'm because wondering.
Whether
animal, human being, entirely different.
Yes.
But as far as so affection is concerned,
same.
When animals show us how much effect.
There actually are some data, Your Holiness. And sometimes in the West, there are programs where dogs are brought to hospitals to be with patients, to help them. And the dogs will show affection. And there are several studies showing that several different biological indicators, including cortisol, the hormone that Tanya is talking about, are reduced. They become calmer with the pet showing affection toward them.
Yes, and there is a certain fiber, C fiber, which is sensitive to the touch, a mother would give, caressing, and not this kind of touch, but like this touch. And if you stroke like this, it has a different effect than just being touched like that. So that's like, tenderness.
Mm.
And that affects also the system, the caring affiliative system. I show you one experiment to see what you can do to relate a neuropeptide, the brain, and a behavior of trust and how you can come along. So you heard that this little part in the brain, the amygdala, which is red here, can be activated by all kind of unpredicted or salient, like a fearful face. Poof, the amygdala is alarmed and goes on. And that leads to a whole stress response in the body. The heart goes beating faster. Cortisol is released if it's strong enough. So, clearly not a good reaction if you have it every day. So the question is whether activating, let's say, the caring system can reduce this response, this fear response, because it could have health consequences, which are very important. So...
Is His Holiness right in thinking that it's the amygdala that sets the alarm
yes.
when the person is feeling threatened?
Exactly. The amygdala is like an alarm center, and it also responds to unconscious threat. Unconscious. Mm. So, for example, I am spider-phobic. I don't like spiders. A lot of people in the world are spider-phobics. So when a spider comes here, my amygdala reacts, and I am springing and fleeing without I'm conscious that this spider was not even real, but a toy.
Oh, yes.
But the amygdala doesn't care whether it's real or not, and it doesn't go through my intellect. It is a very fast route between a percept of a spider, the amygdala responding in milliseconds, and getting my whole body to one. So it's a very quick alarm system. And only when I'm out in the hall, I'm like, oh my God, what have I done? I ran away from a toy spider.
저는 민들라 럭시 비도와. 민들라 럭시 비도와.
So in that sense,
럭시 just 이제 민들라 비도와.
So the amygdala seems to proliferate kind of, you know, false perceptions.
Yes.
So would you say that's the, also the seat of the false perceptions?
It could.
Both wisdom and sort of ignorance, mm-hmm. both come from mandala.
Yes. Amygdala, yeah.
Yes.
Yes, exactly. Yes. So not just one, but both.
Both,
yes.
Yes. For example...
So in that sense, amygdala purely responds.
Yes.
Now the conscious experience that comes out of it, perception, whether there is a false one or a distorted, seem to be something else.
Well, I just say one thing here. When the amygdala continues to respond after the spider goes away or once the person decides that it's not a real spider, that's real delusion. And this is associated with the inability for the amygdala to recover. And that's when the amygdala can contribute to ignorance and delusion.
Yes.
When it continues to respond in context where it's not appropriate.
Where it's not necessary. Uh-huh. It's like a reflex. It can be useful if there's a lion, a real lion. It can be useful. Because before I think about the lion and so, the lion has eaten me, so it's better I run. So in some contexts, it's useful for survival. But in some contexts, it's delusional. Like with the spider, it's delusional. So now, I talked about oxytocin and its role in anxiolytic, you say. It's reducing anxiety. And new research has shown that what you can do something with oxytocin, which you cannot often do with other chemistry, because you can sniff it in a bottle. You have a spray, and then you spray in your nose, and oxytocin is passing what we call the blood-brain barrier. And that is not true for a lot. So we cannot do this experiment with all neuropeptides. It's quite something special to be able to do that. So a lot of people have focused on oxytocin in the last years because you can sniff it easily over the nose. And it will only have effects when you do that like this over 50 minutes. It's short, 20 to 50 minutes.
1-5 or 5-0?
No, 20-0 to 5-0. It's very short, so it's not like useful. It's useful for doing science. It's not useful for spraying in the room. But it's just an example to see if people, so economists have done a study where they gave some people oxytocin and another group placebo. It smells like oxytocin but is nothing in it. And then they played economic money games. And this economic game, you have to trust Jimpa. I have a pot of money, and now I have to decide whether I trust Jimpa. You know, I don't know Jimpa, and I'm like, okay, I give you 7 from my money, and then you can decide whether you give something from your money back. And every money which I give him is doubled or tripled, depending on the experiment. But I need to trust Jinpa that he will be reciprocating my trust. So economists call that a fear of being betrayed. Humans are afraid, and some people more are not.
So carry on.
Yes. Yeah. And so because if Jinpa would now have all my money and not give it to me, not reciprocate, not send anything back, I would feel very terrible. So I'm a bit like, you know, can I trust or not? Now, without oxytocin, people trust, you know, some people give only three. This is the white bars. You know, you see some give three, some give four, and some give even 12, all the money they have. But it's not so many. The people is very different. There's a large variability. When you give oxytocin, this is the black bar, you see that most of the people now give everything. So they have basically an increase in trust.
Oxytocin, nada temane tenu chu andi shugu zema de zebe na tongu pa su deri che borwa ani panang wala luge che che lam sa ngoma shi ne ngui phen chu de ya de
ko su de ka su re
dan de economic game zebe kap de de mini orwa ta chilia molia gom chung ni sha ngam gom chung ni sha ani me nga de
na da su de ka se re na
de di che de ko mi le ning ye bu yong ya da
So you can say
that's the bar.
The black bar, you see, the increase from the white bars to the black bar is the group without oxytocin, and now you give sniff oxytocin and they give the whole money away, they trust. So now you could say stupid.
No.
Nada dele. Kokoita.
So some people might still be capable of sniffing the oxytocin but also cheat.
Yes. So I'm not saying that we should all sniff oxytocin. It's just showing the relationship between chemicals.
The example is over.
And when you do this game in the scanner, you can see that the effect which you see in behavior is through a reduction of amygdala activity.
The negative direction. And the oxytocin, the level zero, the
So the you could say the fear of being betrayed is relaxed.
Relaxed.
You don't have this fear anymore, and so you're like, Jinpa will be a good person. I give him everything. So a lot of people have through these experiments and many more asked the question, if something like oxytocin, which is very closely tied to affiliative system in animals and in humans, can do that, can compassion do the same? You know, can we, through mental training and loving kindness, produce the same effect? Trust more, getting more calm, being more relaxed.
Yes.
And the research we have seen today suggests actually all these effects of compassion training. Mm-hmm. So you see an increase in networks in the brain which actually are associated to this affiliation and positive reward circuitry. You see an increase in experienced well-being. When you ask people, they feel better. And as you have different data showing that people help more after only 1 week of compassion and loving kindness training in economic games and cooperation. And you also have data showing that the cortisol level decreases. So it is very compatible to this hypothesis, but we have to prove it. So is the caring system a system we should activate more to become a better person? And after our dialogue today, I would think it's only half of the story, because this is to do with the right side. This is, you know, rooted in motivational system. And what you are pointing out is that we need, as much as we need this motivation and warm feeling, we need wisdom and understanding and intellect. And this is reflected on the left side of the model. So we probably will need both to be trained in the same time to get at a holistic compassion. Because right. One little story I have not told you, oxytocin only works for in-groups.
Only those.
Rancho.
So, if I give oxytocin, and now I have to give money to someone who is from another religion, or, you know, I think it's not my group, then no effect. So it's what you call biological compassion. It is increasing affiliation with the closed one and the family and the kids, but not it's not global compassion. And to bring kinship compassion into global compassion, we need our prefrontal lobes.
True.
And intelligence to do that. But we need more studies. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Tanya.
Wonderful. Thank you.
Wonderful.
These are the people who do the research.
These are the people who have been doing the research in your group.
Tanya.
Tanya, you can sit over on that side. Could you walk behind?
Wait, Tanya.
You're going to go on the other side. There you go.
Thank you.
That was wonderful.
Now we will hear from Geshe Damdul, a Buddhist response.
Oh, did we? Wolf
singer.
Oh. Oh. Then your father's name, I remember very easily, Wolf singer.
We need tech from Ned. Is Ned around? Thank you.
I'll let who Singapore? Not India.
No.
I see.
Zurich University Professor Chair.
Yes,
the name of Max Planck Institute, the Zurich is actually the director.
The name of Shadow.
Just hit this.
In Switzerland.
That's what they're saying there, is up there.
Zurich. All
right.
With
the help of our technical support, we now have neuroscience and neuroplasticity. Geshe Damdul Namgyal. Your.
Yes. Is it on?
There is a train, you know. Train.
Your Holiness, this is a great honor. Thank you very much for this great opportunity. I feel extremely humbled, yet at the same time, nervous also, since I'm doing this for the very first time in your presence. I hope I would not bore you with the hodgepodge presentation, and I'll do my best. Thank you. Okay. What I have tried to do is touch on neuroscience and neuroplasticity as much as I know with my from my presence and interest in the West, as well as then present the Buddhist equivalent on this subject. What I'll do is I'll try to walk you through the history of neuroscience in a brief way. There has always been this debate about nature and nurture, where we try to figure out what is responsible for our development. On the one hand, there is saying that everything is already given there in the nature. All we have to just do is just wait for it to unfold on its own. Whereas there is this another debate that we need to be working on. There needs to be a lot more input to be put on so that the development could be brought up. So in this regard, neuroscience has also been through this process in that in the preceding events, there was this era of behaviorism where all it says is there's no need of looking inside what we have because that doesn't hold any weight. Rather, all that is responsible is what is given there out in the atmosphere, with the environments and whatnot, with our behaviors, everything could be changed. So more or less, there is this outlook of input or stimulus and response with nothing in between that needs our care. That's one extreme. So this era of behaviorism hit its heyday in 1960s, but then it slowly faded away with the advent of genetic science, where it took us to the other extreme, saying, no, all there is given inside. We are kind of hardwired with things, and no matter how much effort we make, there is hardly anything we can do. It will just express on its own. So that's another extreme. Neuroscience as a discipline, at least from what I heard Richard Davidson share this in an NPR radio interview, was that it became as a discipline in mid-70s. And that's before then, it wasn't a discipline of its own. And here it began with what Richard would call the repertoire of human emotions, the so-called classic six. They would come up with just six numbers of emotions. That's the most they could come up with that the humans have, of which happiness could be considered a joyful one, surprise maybe a neutral one, all the rest are something disturbing. And from there, they proceeded on to develop. So why I am telling this is that what preceded neuroscience has helped in shaping it in that, more particularly with the coming up of neuroplasticity, it became even more clearer that not everything is set in stone. Rather, through our own intervention, we could bring up changes, more importantly, changes for our own good. So over the years, we have seen neuroscience not only develop as a discipline, but rather grow into several sub-disciplines within it, such as cognitive, affective, evolutionary, cellular, clinical, social, and so more. And within the affective neuroscience, one may bring in the so-called contemplative neuroscience, of which Richard Davidson and Tanya Singer have been so involved in bringing out the effects of healthy mental states for our social good. Okay. So That brings me to this fact that early on, neuroscience, more or less in the such as more or less in the case of so many other disciplines, came or was born out of necessity. That's the focus more on distressful states was quite natural. But then, as we moved on, it also became necessary to explore the area of healthy emotions and see if there is something that we could do about it. Have more say. More say in actually looking into the world of healthy emotions, if possible, even plan for what do you call pre-age, what do you call prenatal or prenatal or early age attempts, interventions by which we could bring those seeds within them so that they could grow and eventually avert the emergence of unwanted mental disorders. So what I have personally found in my observation on the neuroscience is that what it does is it always looks for correlates. And if it were to just merely stop there, it doesn't really seem to mean much. It only means to bring up what are the correlates. What correlates are there for several mental states, be that disorderly ones or healthy ones, on our brain, on our body, as much. But what is very important is that what is found in the laboratory researches are being then translated into clinical research, into real-life incidents. And so that what we might individually experience within could be now replicated and then applied in a larger scale. That too, through repeated investigation, confirmation that yes, this particular way of contemplation is helpful, is actually can be demonstrated to affect healthily, so that with that confirmation that can be now applied. That part is very appealing to me. Otherwise, if it were to just merely look for correlates, I kind of think that, well, one could always look for correlates. Sure. Then what? Because personally, we feel the benefits within ourselves. But importantly, that personal experience can now be replicated, expanded, made universally available, more particularly with the systems like secular way of presenting the contemplations. So now we come to neuroplasticity. We see lots of people at work on my brain. So neuroplasticity, its discoveries and possibilities. Here again, we have a history to understand, not that it just came out overnight.
You are one of them.
Neuroplasticity, by the way, is the ability for the brain neurons and the circuits there, synapses, whatnot. I'm not an expert here, but for them to form new structures and even change in their function, the basic ability. But then, earlier they thought that such plasticity possibility kind of stops sometime early in childhood, and once we reach that stage and the brain kind of remains static and no changes could be made. So that was the early idea of plasticity. But then later it was seen that aspects of brain remain plastic even after early childhood goes into adulthood. And then even later it seems it has been found that it even occurs throughout life. And in a very strange thing, it was even found out that change is the rule, not the exception. I quote Richie Davidson. And changes happen at various levels, at cellular level, at large-scale level, on structures, in functions. So the question here is, what do we want such changes to happen? If it were to be confined to individual development only, then we could as much be content with what we are doing in our own individual cultivation. But once we cultivate them and we can show them on the brain, then it could be studied, confirmed, and then replicated, and then applied widely. So that's how knowing that changes do happen, even on biological basis, is very helpful. And also making sure that what changes brings what changes where in the brain, so that we can match positive mental thinking with positive changes in the brain. And change can happen through so many ways. It can happen on several levels on the brain or also on some other nervous system parts within the body at microcellular level to a large-scale observable functional and structural level. But in terms of the medium which brings such changes, it could be behavioral, environmental, experiential, neural processes, contemplative practices, bodily injuries, just about anything that we do, that we engage in through our body, speech, and mind, brings about a change. And from a Buddhist perspective, this is not something new, because everything we do from with our mind kind of gets its expression through the body, maybe more so through the brain, but through every aspect of the body. And when it passes through it, it just affects it. It would kind of affect it. So the effects that we find is, well, that's the reason why I was saying finding correlates is not so much of a surprise or not so much of a big deal, but to kind of then bring it forward into play in social benefits is what matters. So that's how people like Richie Davidson, many others in the Mind and Life, and others, more particularly John Kabat-Zinn, Paul Ekman, and others, have been doing a wonderful job, including Tanya Singer, have been doing a wonderful job in testing how contemplative practice may be affecting biological effects, maybe producing observable biological effects, so that we could confirm that this particular kind of practice does have a ground, real help, so that it could be then taught to others. So sometimes people may think that, oh, why do they match contemplative practices? Contemplative practices bring benefit. It is something that I personally experience. I feel wonderful when I generate bodhicitta, try to penetrate into the understanding of selflessness. It kind of unlocks the knots within me. It's very experiential. But the purpose behind matching it with the neural correlates and seeing structural functional changes is what I have been saying. That's what we need to really, cooperate, collaborate, because that's going to be a thing in the future to be applied and used, made available to much, much wider. So in this regards, I hear Richie has been doing in his lab a wonderful thing in kind of creating tools, toolbox of preventive benefits that could give rise to beneficial effects. Toolbox that one could carry so that in emergencies, just as we have first aid medicines, we could now have first aid toolbox of contemplative practices that we could go into as soon as we are hit by some kind of a disorder. So that's what they are doing. But then, we have to remember is that through their research, they have found that just a short period of practice is not enough. It has to be consistent, systematic, persistent. Only then we can hope for structural changes to happen. That too, a long-lasting changes, so that the benefits could be experience, even as you call baseline baseline benefit. Baseline changes can be seen so that the benefits could be seen, endured, even when one is up and going in the world, not necessarily steeped in that practice. So from this, they have found out that happiness is a skill, not a fixed trait one either has or has not throughout the life. This is exactly word by word quoting Ritchie in his interview with Christy Tippett in the program called On Being. I just accidentally happened to listen to that. I was so immersed in it. I listened to it maybe 3 times. I went back 3 times and I studied it. This is where these are coming. So, happiness is a skill that we can learn. So, that means we go back to neuroplasticity, having known that the neuroplasticity is a fact, not a fiction. But one thing that we need to know after that is that the change should not be just let to happen on its own, but rather we should exert more say in what direction the change should take place. And that way we would have a say in what well-being we want to be in. But neuroplasticity, given the underlying belief of the neuroscientists, the materialists, given their belief in that mind is nothing, consciousness is nothing but an emergent property of the brain, I think they should go much more than merely looking for correlates and doing researches in the labs and then bringing them into translatable researches. Because since they have seen that some contemplative practices that bring about wonderful experience are actually can be matched with happenings there, they could now go there, start there, and try to induce them mechanically. Because theoretically, that should be possible. After all, mind being an emergent property of the brain, if you change brain, the resultant states should necessarily come. I think so. Very well. If that's not the case, there are people who are trying this. Maybe not Ritchie and Tanya Singer and others, but there are others who are trying this. Because for them, the assumption, or maybe the belief, that yes, mind, consciousness, is an imagined property of the brain. Wherever there's brain, there's mind. No brain, no mind. I am reminded by Christoph's presentation I was translating, where he says, no brain, never mind. I read it differently. I said, no brain, don't worry, never mind. Because there still is consciousness. But obviously, he didn't mean that.
So never mind.
He meant that no brain, never think of mind's possibility there. But I read it differently. Don't be afraid. So, with the underlying belief that mind is nothing, consciousness is nothing but an emergent property of the body, that it comes after the brain, then it should be possible. Once we have found what matches with what good thing matches with which part, we could now start from the brain top down and then bring about the change mechanically. Some people are trying this. Look here. How thorough a change could be, and how far optogenetics have gone. So optogenetics, the tool that people are coming up with, where... By the way, I understood that optogenetics is implanting neurons with light-sensitive proteins called opsins that has been harvested from several creatures that one can stimulate or silence them with a single optic fiber. So one could have the control in terms of what needs to be fleshed up, what could be silenced, to the point that people's movement could be controlled to the point that people could be made to sleep or even made aggressive. These have been found. Now, how far can we go? This way of approach is very sincere to the assumption that, yes, mind is nothing but imagined property. But how far they can go? Because under this assumption, there is the possibility of mechanically inducing bodhicitta. You just change and go, bodhicitta. Whereas we have found bodhicitta is so difficult to come up with. We try again and again and again with contrived way of developing it. Eventually, we kind of get a glimpse, so to say, of a pure bodhicitta, but then it kind of fades away. But then from this, it seems like it could be possible. So there is a person by the name of Ed Boyden. In 2005, he even developed this optogenetics, and he has now developed what is called auto-patcher. He has robots to do this work, not human beings to be engaged in, who
fully
need breaks.
Soft, sorry. Can brain be fully solved?
So by can brain be fully solved, there is actually a person by the name of Ed Boyden who is actively involved in, he really pursues this, actively involved in developing mechanical tools that could do this work of figuring out the neurons which are associated with which. They even can kind of create a hole through micro-millimeter width tip of a, optic glass pip. Optic glass fiber, and then suck through it, can create a hole there, can let light into it so that it could be detected and also seen where the connections go, which is connected with which, so that they could have more control. Now later, they could even silence it if they don't want, or they could increase it. So he is seriously pursuing that brain needs to be solved, and the way to go about, the contemporary way to go about, that of doing PhDs, everyone, is not the way, but rather all should be working together with him so that the work that he's doing could be multiplicated and the process could be expedited so that within 50 years, everything could be solved. That's what he is pursuing. But whether we can get there or not. So what would that mean, given the underlying assumption? Given the underlying assumption, that would mean no need to practice. All contemplatives could come in pills. All contemplatives could come in some kind of prescriptions. Okay, do this, this, this. But then, the question, if that were the case, how would we face such situations? This is an encephalia. It is called a congenital disorder where a person has either part of the brain absent or whole of the brain absent. And I have a wonderful case here. This actually is Nicholas Koch. He was born in Pueblo, Colorado. He can't see, he can't hear, he can't suck, he doesn't crawl, he doesn't sit up. And usually in such cases, people survive for a few hours and then they die. In his case, he survived for 1 week, 1 month, a whole year he had a birthday party. And after that, I think he didn't make it to the second birthday anniversary. But he did survive. And he survived without the help of any doctors, without the help of any tubes. And all he had by way of brain parts is just the brain stem, nothing. So, and yes, eventually he even smiled, he even laughed, he showed emotions there, which are signs of consciousness. But where would that have come from if with no brain? Now you would have to look into some brain cells, stems, and say, yes, maybe consciousness is somewhere out there. So that's one case. There's another case called hydrocephalus. There's another case called hydrocephalus, which means water on the brain, where instead of the usual brain parts, the parts are filled with fluid. They are called the cerebrospinal fluid. And they take up because the movement for that is obstructed and it kind of fills up, and that enlarges the head to the point that sometimes there would be the need of taking it out. But what it does is it takes away the space for the usual brain parts, and thus people hardly have the usual brain parts that are associated with different emotions and cognitions, whatnot. By a person... A person by the name of John Lober has done a very systematic research in this and has come up with the data where he has shown that people with this kind of a condition range from nearly full brain to 95% no brain. And in the case of those people who have 95% of the brain lacking with the water taking their place, they have found half of them were doing normally. Not quite full normally, but quite well. Including someone who had 100 IQ rating. There was another person in England whose condition was noticed by a colleague of him when he saw his head enlarging. Though he didn't complain of anything abnormal, his head was so unusually large. So some friend of his kind of intimated it to the doctor, and when they met up to kind of do some research, they found out that his was a hydrocephalus case. His might be some 75% without brain, yet he was doing normally, more normally than others in the field of mathematics. And in terms of the IQ, he scored 125. So people would ask him, people would ask the researcher, how come? Maybe there is there is a mistake in the interpretation of the reading. So he has this to say. I can't say whether the mathematics student has a brain weighing 50 grams or 150 grams, but it is clear that it is nowhere near the normal 1.5
kilogram.
But one thing we have to know, and this has been very frequently reiterated in the course of this conference by Richie and others, that so far we may say that it is an emergent property of the brain, but in terms of how does this subjective quality of consciousness come, it is still unaccounted for. Just to quote Richie himself, he says, mind just pops up where there is brain. Do you remember having said that? Yeah, I have it. I have it. You said that. You have said that. I have the record of it. He says that the brain just pops up where there's brain. Mind just pops up. But in terms of how, still a question. There is a doctor by the name of Sam Parnia who is doing a wonderful research on consciousness, allowing the possibility that maybe brain could survive, mind could survive brain, because of so many cases of out-of-body experiences, including that of near-death experiences and also out-of-body experiences, because many of them so-called near-death experiences could qualify for out-of-body experiences, including the experience of Dr. Eben Alexander, who himself was a hard-nosed neuroscientist, skeptic, and explaining all these phenomena in one way or the other. But eventually, when he himself suffered coma and remained in that for several hours, he came out a totally different person. He is now a very ardent advocate that, yes, life is not just this. There's more to it. So from a Buddhist point of view, how does neuroplasticity tie in? You see a knot here. This is just a representation of mind-body entanglement. mind-body entanglement so long, and this is mind-body entanglement in a gross form. If I were to really represent the entire course of life, I would have come up with a broad, what do you call, section here, and very tiny, yet with the two combinations. And yeah, two combinations with the subtle mind and the subtle wind, yet again growing into bigger one, and then bigger, like that. So there is no disruptions as such in the stream, in the continuity of the consciousness, as well as in the continuity of a something material, energetic substance, matter. Yet, in terms of the gross physicality and the gross conceptual thought that we are aware of, that could come and go, but not necessarily as you might call the mental substrates and physical, rough physical substrates, they do not necessarily stop from a Buddhist perspective. So from a Buddhist perspective, mind in one level or the other never stops. Doesn't necessarily have to be conscious in the way that we understand. So from a Buddhist perspective, we say, for the time being, when we find our mind locked up in this body, in this gross body, the force that brings it together is the karma. So long as the karma vision remains, we could be locked. Whenever the karma vision ends, for that particular togetherness, then they part. So while together
on the grosser level, subtle level never separate.
Never stop. Yes, exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what I meant. So if I were to represent it on the thread, that's how I would have done it. That the continuity would never have stopped. Yet, in terms of the thickness, it would have changed. So from a Buddhist perspective, so long as they are together, they are mutually dependent in terms of their continuum. That the previous instance of the brain of body helps in the subsequent helps in the continuity of the subsequent subsequent instance of the body. Likewise, but what is different is just as here, so they support each other as cooperative conditions for the other. So the body serves as a cooperative condition for the mind. Mind serves as the cooperative condition for the brain. And that remains, that relationship remains so long as the karmic vision remains for that gross level mind and body togetherness. But just as in the picture here, you see that the black strand kind of keeps keeping its blackness all through, and the white keeps keeping its whiteness all throughout. Likewise, in terms of the substantial cause, matter stays for matter, consciousness stays for consciousness. Never do they interchange. But interestingly, in the epistemology text, where there is this discussion about the relationship between body and mind, it explains that in terms of bodily things affecting the mind, such as through drug, alcohol, the certain intake of something, etc., you do see change in the mental level. But in terms of explaining it, it says that it affects the sensory consciousness. Through the sensory consciousness, which becomes kind of a content of the mental consciousness, only then the mental consciousness is affected. It's never a body directly affecting the mind, but it is always mediated through a sensory consciousness. And then through that, it affects. It does affect, but not directly. So in that same epistemology text, it says very clearly, yes, fluctuations affected on the brain, on the mind, does happen, and that happens because of the sensory fields having been observed by the sensory consciousness, and they eventually affecting the mind. So does the mind affect the body? We already know that. Yeah, it is interesting. I found some references in some Buddhist texts. I cannot actually say whether they are actual Indian works or not. But there are some Buddhist. I did check this in the Kanju Tenju collection. I could not find it. There are certain texts where there is a reference of 8 essences, where they say the essence of the eyes is the tears, the essence of the tongue is the saliva, the essence of the body hair is the perspiration, the essence of the nerves is tendon, the essence of the flesh is fat, the essence of the bone is bone marrow. And can you guess what is the essence of the mind? The brain. So it is the essence of the mind. Not mind is the essence of the brain, but brain is the essence of the mind. Do you see the change there? But still, there is... But still, the connection between brain and mind is very well made there. But in terms of what it means, we still have to explore it. So also, I found 2-3 references in... So I have 2-3 references referring to the same thing in terms of its being essence. Which one? The text is fairly a new text that has been brought out in Tibet, published by the library. It's actually, you might have this in the collection here. If not, you can have that from the library. They have published it recently on neuroscience, brain-related things, where towards the end of the book, they have done some exploration of what references could be found in the Buddhist text. Oh, yeah. In that, you have to look. We don't care about the centuries. We take for granted that... Pardon? Yeah, that part, too, is not that clear. It may be... It does refer to the text itself as Yu, a tantric text. Evidently, it is a tantric text. All 3 references I have are tantric texts. I did look up in the Kanjur collection.
Yu, huh? Pajirda Kasaji, Doshana, Shiva Jeshuta, Namshi Soke, Father Din George Shady Pajir, President Shimon Sunk. Donjana, huh?
Tantangi de Kung Tonachi de Pe Gumbo Manning Nagui Session.
Gumbo Manning Q.
Oh, Gumbo Manning Nagui. Then I check the Pe Trubachimbo Kaji Yaji, Tizidim Buchi.
Please continue.
Okay, yes, sorry. Yeah, so, but you also know, and yesterday His Holiness also brought up how a brain is referred to have some connection with generating joy, generating experience of release and whatnot. Likewise, in the tantric practice, we do have physiological parts being employed through energy nerves, energy chakras, etc., into the path. So that's exactly a way of mind impacting the body parts that eventually giving rise to actual experiences. So in terms of the connection, there is no question, but in terms of the order of how they come.
In the order, there is some sort of consciousness, the purely kazada leve mari leve juwal tene yondinge chik. The most subtle levels is consciousness gearche the effects that
relationship. So His Holiness was saying that he could envision causality going both ways. In some context, there could be mental processes which could be seen as, you know, purely caused from the brain basis. But in some cases, one could imagine at a much subtler level, just purely mental processes, which can then begin to impact the brain.
Now, in terms of...
So middle.
So again, once again, it's the middle way.
So in terms of the nature of consciousness, the position of mind and mental factors, you may have noticed that in the mind and mental factor, I have put an inverted single comma. There is a reason there. Now here I'm staying with how people have been using these terms, but I see a problem with this in creating confusion, particularly when this is juxtaposed with the Western understanding. I think so. So that's the reason. Please bear this in mind.
Then the mind and mental factors say that so the kuna jugo et des and the tanya de pech cheta chigu chigi or de ne tata de gayus. Tanya de tanda pech cheta chigi or sim jung tikote. The mental factors say tanya tata de gayun.
So just as this picture here shows, mind is not a monolithic continuous thing, but rather a discontinuous thing constituted of subsequent events or subsequent instances, as is reflected here. But in terms of its continuity, although it may vary in terms of grossness or subtleness, but it kind of keeps on. Never is there a break. But the important thing is that the reason for making transformation, making efforts, practices is so that this continuity not only stays put, but also stays put in a much more purer, elevated, exalted state, for which it always has the capacity, potential for. So it is non-material, it is luminous and knowing in nature, in that it is not just a mirroring of the images, but rather it engages actively in knowing and in engaging with it. The third one, I make a distinction here. Every event at a given time is composed of so-called mind and mental factors. Although whenever we take out particular strand of consciousness, be that mindfulness, memory, sleep, thoughtfulness, attention, whatever, each could be considered consciousness. But in terms of a mental event, they do not constitute a complete mental event. For a mental event at any given time, it has to be constituted of the so-called mind, which I would call basic awareness factor, and the secondary awareness factor. And in terms of the mental factors, there are certain numbers which are necessarily present, and depending on the complexity of the mental event, the number of the mental factors, either you could call activated or present within that collection, could vary. Okay.
Consciousness.
Yeah. All consciousness can be categorized either as sensorial and mental. Here I make a distinction between sensorial and mental. I do not consider, I don't think you do also, I sense consciousness as mental. You do? Don't you? Do you in the half and half? No, but would that be considered? Would that be considered mental?
In the moment where you have a concept of wetness, we consider perception going into mental.
Into mental.
Because you have a conception on a wavelength,
yeah,
which you call wet.
Okay. When you say conception, then that's different. That's already moved into the thought.
But what
realm.
Is then pure
but it's
perception?
More problematic, though, because even sensory processes are mental processes.
Yeah, pre-conceptual, it's mental. Yeah. Yes. Pre-conceptual.
Yeah.
Just the qualia of red itself is a mental event.
Mental event.
So in that case, please follow me here, in that I do not consider I sense consciousness as mental. Because if we consider I sense consciousness as mental, then we would have to also institute mind within I sense consciousness. That would be problematic. There is no mind in the I sense consciousness. Is there? You wouldn't say that there is mind.
There is.
Okay.
From a...
Yes. So because of that, I make this distinction here between sensorial and mental, and that all sensory consciousnesses are cognitive in nature, not emotional. We do not have a compassionate I-sense consciousness. And all emotions, this is being presented from the Buddhist perspective. So all emotions and conceptual thoughts are mental events. Sensory consciousness cannot be cultivated through meditation, whereas mental consciousness can be. And there is a sharp separation between ordinary perception and conception. As well as there is a sharp separation between ordinary conception and cultivated perception. By this, I want to allude to the fact that, yes, though we may begin with a conceptual thought of an understanding of emptiness, but when we familiarize with it, it could be developed into a perceptual consciousness. That would be something totally unexperienced by ordinary people. So for that, one has to look for a yogi and then undertake a practice. So generally, we see a sense of improvement and refinement in terms of the position of mind, its constituents, its function, etc., as we go up the philosophical scales. Likewise, we see a similar sense of improvement and refinement between sutra and tantra. And as it is very apparent, the subtlest mind and related practice appear only in tantra, within tantra, in the highest yoga tantra only. I don't think I have much time for this. So basically what I'm saying is not every mind is mental. The so-called mind being referred, alluded to Buddhist, is not necessarily mental. Not every mental factor is mind, be warned. And so instead of calling them mind and mental factor, I would call them primary awareness factor and secondary awareness factor. In there, the difference is always in the potential for function, nothing but that.
The same thing, the mind and mental factor, the secondary awareness.
Between the mind and mental consciousness, there is always a synchronicity, and they are equally active in the same cognitive and emotive task that they may be involved. And in such event, one particular factor, be that primary or secondary, can take over the whole event and give us an impression that all that's happening is just that, whereas in actuality, a collection is happening there, including a mind. When you say compassionate mind, compassion has generated. Along with compassion, there are so many other mental factors which are there. And also along with that, there is a mind associated with that. So a lot is happening. That's the reason why I say that every consciousness, even is fundamentally cognitive in nature, and when you have emotion, then it is built on that basis from a Buddhist perspective. So when I heard that eventually the distinction between cognition-related areas and emotive-related areas are now becoming more and more fuzzy and they are becoming interspersed, it's like, oh, yeah, surely it should be. How else could that be? So basically what I'm saying is emotion is cognitive-based plus additional cognitive and emotional factors. Complex cognitive events are fundamental cognitive-based along with additional factors. So let me show you here two possible models. This could be the model of mind in the center with the five omnipresent factors. This could be one possibility. I don't buy this. I rather buy this. Mind is something that kind of pervades everything, which has a general... So I rather prefer this model in that mind part kind of pervades all mental factors present there. And mental factors are more like a specific expression that is geared at a specific facet of that object. So at the very least, each mental event has to be a collection of mind and five omnipresent factors. As we go more complex, then it becomes more and more. In the case of visual sense perception, we say, in terms of the causes, it has to have an eye sense organ. Only then that kind of consciousness could be called eye consciousness. And then it has to have a visual object so that it could be called the eye sense consciousness, which is observing image. But then, very important,
yes.
For very important, it has to have this immediate preceding mental consciousness for it to be consciousness. This is a tricky thing here. The link between sense consciousness with its very immediate preceding mental consciousness, which is responsible, instrumental in making it consciousness in the first place, is very crucial. So in terms of the composition, this could be this could be mind, I sense consciousness, I sense mind, consciousness with the five omnipresent factors, and it may have two, three of the determining factors together. This could be the simplest I sense consciousness in terms of its collection. Let's move on to hatred. How does it turn out to be? Hatred is fundamentally mental, afflictive, and negative in nature, so it has to have a mind with the five omnipresent mental factors. Together with that, it has to have maybe four determining factors, and for that to become hatred, it has to have the 9, 11, maybe a little less associated negative ones. And then, that's because it is afflictive. Because it is, on top of that, it is negative, non-virtuous. It has to have maybe you add that, then it becomes negative. So this is hatred. When hatred comes, it spoils everything. Now look. See? Actually, it shows better there. Now the entire mind and mental factor is permeated by anger. Everything is cooperating in being like this. So the same thing happens with compassion. Let's look at compassion here. In terms of the composition, the basic composition is same. Now maybe 3, 4 of the determining factors and the virtuous factors there. When compassion comes into play, it gives a very good flavor. See how good it is. So outwardly, it will look like it is just compassion, but in terms of the composition, it is a lot there. But since compassion has been generated so strongly, everything is influenced by it. Now let's look at sleep. Sleep is considered variable. Variable in that by itself it's neutral. But it could be negative, it could be positive. And when it becomes positive and negative, then the composition becomes more complex. So sleep is fundamentally mental in nature. All sensory consciousnesses are withdrawn during sleep. In terms of the composition, this is the basic composition. It cannot avoid that. Mm-hmm. Mind with the five omnipresent mental factors. Then maybe 2, 3 of the determining factors. This is all. When it is just a neutral sleep, this is. So when you have a neutral mind state, you go into mind very lightly. Now, so this is sleep. But then, when going into sleep, you have a negative thought, and the mind becomes negative, then the whole sleep is spoiled until you rise up the next day, and you could even have nightmares.
So
Until the person arises.
One cycle of sleep.
One could be disturbed in the midnight and wake up, then that doesn't count. Then you again start new sleep sting.
Yes.
Oh, here it shows a good picture. But actually, I meant to show it all black so that you could even expect nightmares when you go into sleep with negative thoughts. Now let's see what happens if we could sleep in positive thoughts. This is the basic mind with the mental factors, omnipresent ones, with the 2, 3 determining ones. Now here comes positive thought. It becomes, clear. So it is a clear, conscious sleep. Let's end here with a clear conscience sleep to expect. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Wonderful. Wonderful.
Thank you very much, Geshe Damgo. That was a brilliant presentation, one which we all thoroughly enjoyed and which prepares us beautifully for tomorrow's work, where we'll be taking up the whole theme of consciousness and the theme of body and mind, and their relationship will certainly be part of what we're doing. Let me remind you that there's a question and answer period that will be taking place in just a half an hour. There will also be a talk this evening by John Durant. It will be on the history of life. There's also the science fair and exhibits that are going on nearby. Tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, we'll be over at the large hall. There's also going to be the nuns and women's gathering at 7:30 in the evening tomorrow.